You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Mr. Jones's Neighborhood. Good morning, neighbor. I'm glad we're together again. We have a very special show for you today on Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, the children's program for reluctant adults. I'm the host of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. On today's show, we're wrapping up KBOO's special programming just for you fundraising drive starting in March. The special programming has included tributes to Black History Month, World Radio Day, and International Women's Day, along with bluegrass and metal music marathons. Certainly, an eclectic offering designed to appeal to the great diversity of our community. So let's close the drive with a cherry on top, especially for listeners who love comedy and radio theater, by welcoming a very special guest, David Osman of the legendary Firesign Theater. David's one of my audio comedy heroes, perhaps yours as well, and a major reason why I got into radio, but please don't hold that against him. He comes to us remotely from his home on Whidbey Island, proving once again that you can be in two places at once on the radio. David will be talking about two of the Firesign Theater's latest projects, Dope Humor of the 70s, a whopping 144 minutes of archival material from the group's radio shows of the early 1970s, and George LeRoy Tirebiter, the complete collection, which collects completely the performances featuring perhaps David's most famous character with the able assistance of his fellow Firesigns and friends. But wait, as they say in all those lovable, stupid TV ads, there's more. Thanks to the generosity of David, his comedy partner Phil Proctor, and the Firesign Theater's incredible archivist, Taylor Jessen, we have a special offer. For those of you contributing $120 or more, either as a one-time donation or sustaining membership, you'll not only get the satisfaction of supporting community radio, you'll also get, as our thanks to you, digital downloads of the Firesign Theater's latest projects, Dope Humor of the 70s, and George LeRoy Tirebiter, the complete collection, plus a set of bonus Firesign material from the KBOO archives. It's as simple as going to the KBOO website, kboo.org, and clicking on the big donate button on the top right of the screen. Please join us now for a very special conversation with David, and if you're up for a chat, we're online, ready to talk Firesign Theater with you. Just go to kboo.org, log in with your KBOO account or register for one, and you'll see a Chat With Us button in the lower right. Click on that, and Mr. Jones, no relation, will be there waiting for you, as creepy as that might sound. It truly is another beautiful day in the neighborhood. David, welcome back to KBOO, the unofficial flagship of the Firesign Theater here in Portland.
Boy, you can make it official. We love KBOO. It's been around as a community station, as long as I can remember, you know, in that great surge of community stations in the,
exactly,
in the 70s and 80s, KBOO. Yeah, so I'm delighted to be here, there, here. We're always, how can you be in two places at once? It's radio, easy.
Now, I want to start off with a wonderful memory I have of talking to you on KBOO. This was for a show we did in June 2015. You were calling in from your home on Whidbey Island. It was a sad occasion because we were talking about the passing at that time of Phil Austin, who had died a few weeks previous, and it was kind of a celebration of his life on the air. But one thing I remember is I had you on the phone on hold, and I was playing a bit from Nick Danger with you and Phil. You were Catherwood. And I was monitoring you just to make sure you were still there so I could get you right on the air. And you were mouthing along, or actually out loud, talking along with the lines, Catherwood's and Phil's and Nick Danger's. So I just love that. I still remember it.
I was probably totally unconscious, you know.
Yes, it was 11 o'clock at night.
So, I was unconscious, absolutely.
Yeah, I was too, but I guess we did a show. It worked out.
Yeah, so that was the last time we talked is when Phil was gone. Boy, right. That was after Peter, you know, and I mean, they both came as a real surprise to us. And it was unexpected.
Yeah, I talked to Phil Proctor. He said that you and him actually made a pact. Well, you'll tell each other. It won't be you'll die and then, hey.
That's right. Hey, they get that horrible phone call. Call the New York Times. The first phone call with Pete was called the New York Times, which we had to go and call John Goodman, get a quote. I mean, you know, you immediately you were on like, it's, you know, in this news hustle. If somebody dies, you're immediately involved in this kind of news hustle. It's weird. It's very strange.
Well, I want to talk about something that, since nobody died recently, or nobody in the Firesign Theater, fortunately, I want to start off talking about the new release. It's actually two records, or LPs, as they used to be called back in the day. It's called Dope Humor of the 70s. It's available on vinyl from Stand Up Records and also as a digital download. And it contains pieces from the Firesign Theater's early 70s radio show, Dear Friends, which you performed live in the KPFK studios in North Hollywood, I think, every Sunday evening. Was that right, David?
The Dear Friends show was like an 8 o'clock show, something like that, 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening for an hour. Dope Humor of the 70s not only goes back further to the Firesign Theater radio hour, and forward to Just Folks, which was the follow-up radio series. We would do these, you know, 10, 12, 13, you know, it was that kind of chunk that you commit to of doing a dozen shows, a quarter, whatever. And so the Dope Humor album, the LP, which our archivist, Taylor Jessen, just really loved the idea of putting an LP set out. And it really looks like a Herb Alpert album from the 70s. It's really great. For people who remember the Firesign's Dear Friends album, that was just almost entirely from the Dear Friends radio show. I hand edited all of those. The point at that time was that we had this 36 minute album, you know, it had half hours. They were too long to play on the radio for most people. And so we decided we would have some drop-ins, shortcuts. And at that time, you know, you didn't do a part of drop-ins that you could chunk on the radio. So I edited them all down from the air checks of the Dear Friends show and put those albums together. And of course, we were all engaged in it. Everybody listened to everything. But basically, it was cuts that you could put on a big commercial album, which that would have been our fourth album. We were doing very well. What's happened with Dope Humor from the 70s is that Taylor has ranged a bit farther. So there are some really amazing cuts. I was I laughed my way through listening to it because I avoided really listening to it when it was being prepped. I thought, oh, wait, and put it on the turntable. And yeah, there are things I wouldn't have put on that Columbia album, that's for sure. Yeah, no, we were wild on the air. We really were. And there's a lot of extra material as an additional download to the LPs. I don't know how much more, an hour more, 2 hours, I don't know.
I actually got that here. The LP, the two LPs actually run 82 minutes and 34 tracks, and then 144 minutes for the digital download. And there's more. I kind of one of those late night commercials. A 56-page PDF booklet with pictures.
Oh, yeah.
I love reading it and some of the original scripts with notes.
Yeah, Taylor really collected everything he could for that download. And that's kind of the way we're proceeding at the time is to recycle material that you may have heard or may have been able to access back in the day. But now it's improved sound, all kinds of extras because we've gained so much more information about ourselves. And Taylor has put that whole booklet together. There's a similar booklet that goes with the Tire Biter, the George Tire Biter download. They all have, are amplified So it may not be in your hand, which we all miss, you know, but you can get those two LPs, and they are, you can hold them up just like this. It's great. It's great. I love putting them on and putting the needle on, and it's good.
I actually still love that scratchy sound. You know, it's the vinyl doesn't have to be perfect for me, especially at the end when it round and round and round. I remember, because there's so many Firesign fans out there, when we first started listening. So when I was in college, we would put the record on and maybe with, you know, one of our favorite refreshments, and actually just kind of stare at the record as it goes round and round, but listen extremely intently, which I don't think I don't think our attention spans, mine included, are that good anymore, to kind of pick everything up like that and actually just listen for the length of a record, which is 40, 45 minutes in those days.
Yeah, it could be. Well, you know, the Nick Danger is 28, and How Can You Be in Two Places is also 28. It's the longest possible LP album with those two half-hour, virtually half-hour sides. I think Dwarf is 36 minutes. I mean, they were major motion pictures as far as we were concerned. And they're still right out there. I mean, they're still being downloaded. And, you know, I mean, I have to say that Sony owns all of those albums. So what we are doing, what Phil and Taylor and I are doing, are going around Columbia, Sony, and re-releasing live performances, radio, visual, just everything else. And people seem to like it.
When I was researching the interview, it's an incredible treasure chest of content. You guys were just amazingly productive in terms of actually the output, but also the quality of it was just amazing. So the late 60s, early 70s, not just the radio performances, but those first few albums, Waiting for the Electrician, up till 1975, say, In the Next World, You're on Your Own. I was wondering, what do you think were some of the factors that led to all that great work and productivity?
Well, right place, right time, for one thing. The fact that we got that Columbia contract completely off the wall because of Peter's celebrity doing as the Wizard of Oz on Radio Free Oz. He was asked to do an album. He said, I have this comedy group, which he didn't have. He had to send Phil Proctor an airplane ticket. And we wrote that album, and it was... It was just full of wonderful enthusiasm at the very beginning. We really couldn't stop for about 5 years. And I think that's pretty characteristic of a run, you know, is you get about 5 years and then everything has changed, sort of everything has moved around and you readjust. And the same thing happened with Columbia Records. You know, we did the Dear Friends album actually confused people who expected another Don't Crush That Dwarf. Well, you know, it was done for another purpose. And people were also surprised at The Giant Rat of Sumatra. You know, not quite the same thing. No, that was the other thing we do. That's Anything You Want To. That's the other side of the Firesign Theater. Literally, I think of it as the flip side. and then returning with Everything You Know Is Wrong, and with the movie of Everything You Know Is Wrong, you know, that satisfied that particular kind of audience who were just about to leave. They were just about to graduate. They had graduated. They were gone. It was the 80s. You know what I'm saying? So in a career sense, we had a wonderful, lucky run at that time. We were a touring rock band. We were promoted the same way, advertised the same way, packaged the same way. And did we think of ourselves the same way? Maybe. In a sense, you know, kind of in a parody of the rock band kind of thing. I mean, you know, they were all at Columbia Records where we were. It was, everybody was in the studio next door. It was a very funny time, you know. And when that Columbia Records contract ran out after In the Next World, You're on Your Own, they didn't pick up our 1976. We had a huge project for 76. And instead of doing an album, I ran for vice president as George Tirebiter. And that was, that took an enormous amount of energy. Procter and Bergman were on the road. They did a couple of albums during that time. Phil Austin and I did a couple of theatrical evenings, plus another, plus we wrote a couple of movies. You know, you keep the career goes punching on. By the time what I call the Fighting Clowns of Hollywood period came, which was 2 or 3 years later, 79, once again, it was back. Once again, I remember, saying how, just like it was the last time we got together. I thought the same thing in 1992 at our 25th anniversary. Oh, just like it was the last time. Because we brought the same things to it almost all the time. And we had an early financial agreement that was pretty much in place through our entire career. So there was no agent stealing 15%. There was no management. There was none of that. It was just us. So I think that run that run of Columbia Records that really made our name, they're still in print. They're still relevant. They're still funny. They're still in print, or at least they're stolen, you know, at least you can access them.
As most digital content is these days.
Yeah. Well, we got rasty about that at the beginning, but realized there's nothing you could do about it. I just think we were in that decade, we were just in our early 30s, very creative. We were all really creative and had really creative energies. We all came out of radio. Peter was a radio natural. We'd all worked as producers. It didn't take us long to learn how to be producers in the studio because we came from radio. So it wasn't that much. We had to work through engineers at Columbia, right up to Giant Rat. We did that at RCA, and we mixed that one ourselves. You can tell because the stereo field is way over, right?
I was going to mention that when you said that, David, that you also were recording during a period of great change and evolution in the recording industry. I mean, look at Sgt. Pepper's. I think that was 4-track. And then a few years later, you had 24 tracks to work with, and the Fire Sign took full advantage.
Absolutely. The studio was in between being a radio studio and a music producing studio. I mean, the actual building, the rooms. And the room we recorded Electrician and How Can You Be and Danger, I think we're all in the same studio B. It had a radio producer's booth up on the wall. You've seen those pictures of them looking down at the actors and on the microphone and the sound effects guy. There was a Hammond B3 with the speaker, the Leslie speaker. There was a very early Moog synthesizer. They were all, and Phil Proctor ran around and found all the old gray painted CBS radio sound effects. And we brought the door and the marching men. They were all there. And he came back and he said, I found the echo chamber. It's under the staircase. There's a huge spring. And that was the echo chamber. It was a huge spring under a staircase. Reverberated. So we had a lot of fun just in that sense. And also interacting with the rock guys who were there. There were musicians there all the time. They loved what we did. We at that very beginning, we did a whole track with Jeremy Clyde of Chad and Jeremy.
I didn't know that. I knew you. Yeah. What weren't you produced by James William Guercio, who also did right. Chicago?
Yes, we were. The first album they were our managers there for Rock and Roll Time, and it came down to, would you guys like to tour with the Beach Boys? And we looked at each other and said, and you know, you could just hear the audience, right? Beach Boys. Yeah, they're not going to listen to the Fireside Theater. It just wouldn't work, you know. That would have been another career. I'm not even sure Procter & Bergman could have worked with them in that way, you know, stadium. stadium was too big for us.
I mean, a stadium. But I saw recently on Facebook you posted that you're currently working with Taylor Jessen on shows from LA's Magic Mushroom. And yes. I looked that up, and that was mostly rock and folk. I saw Canned Heat, Iron Butterfly, Jackson Browne, Phil Oakes, Taj Mahal played there, but also the Firesign Theater. And you were described by the Library of Congress as the Beatles of comedy. So that audience was also your audience too, right? The rock audience was also the Firesign comedy audience.
Yes, it was really identical. It had come out. There were no comedy clubs. Comedy hadn't happened quite yet. There was some early stand-up, and you remember all those guys with the telephones in their ears sitting on stools.
Bob Newhart, yeah.
God bless them. They were very funny people, and they you know, broke a lot of stereotypes in their time. But there were no comedy clubs. There were folk clubs. And as we're at the beginning of Bob Dylan's career here, there were folk clubs. They were, as I understand it from Phyllis Diller, they were all basically run by gangsters, and they were all gay clubs at the very beginning. What an amazing woman she was. We had a great interview, and I loved the people from that period. So we said, because we had a little set, and there were four of us, we said, can we just work with a solo artist? Well, you know, you just was the list of people who came in, Taj Mahal, and, you know, all these wonderful old blues guys would sit on the stage singing, "I've got the blues, I got serious blues, I've had blues 1907, I got the blues." And you know, the bitter Son House, who must have been in his 70s or 80s at the time. So that was the crossover. And that same building then became the Improv after the Ash Grove played.
So the Magic Mushroom and the Ash Grove were two separate venues, though, right?
Two separate venues. The Magic Mushroom was on Ventura Boulevard, North Hollywood, and was a club. The Beatles had actually been introduced, I think, in L.A. because that club was owned by, I can't remember his name, but a radio DJ of the time. And it had been, you know, it had been just a club and then was converted into this kind of underground, all ages, no liquor. And, you know, it was Iron Butterfly. I mean, the next night it was Iron Butterfly after Firesign. So we went in there at, we had 3 hours. We went in at 9 to 10, 10 to 11, 11 to 12. And I was kind of Peter's sidekick at that time. I was always really Peter's sidekick for Radio Free Oz. A really interesting relationship over 50 years. And the Phils were not on the show at the beginning. Peter had made this contract. He's going to do the show from here, 3 hours, Sunday night. And it was KRLA. So it was 100,000 watts border to border. Yeah, I mean, you could really hear us. And we had to get the Phils on the show. So we started writing. First was an improv. The first night was Bridie Murphy Eve. And it was a Halloween show. In 67, 1967 Halloween. We've always celebrated Halloween kind of as our anniversary, and because of that. And we did two pieces. One was, as I had remembered it, basically a sketch piece called The Seance. We were just figuring out how to write. So we started by writing what we would call a sketch rather than a playlet, rather than a thing that had a bigger dimension. And so we wrote that, and I hadn't heard it for a million years. I'll run the tape back in a second. So the second piece was called Exorcism in Your Daily Life. And it was the Irby classroom film of your dreams. Gee, Dad, I've got to write a paper on exorcism, and I'd rather go play ring ball with Bruce. Well, gee, son, why don't we just go down and talk to Dr. Bob down at the bank? You know, we used that device for the rest of our career. And that was opening night, basically was opening night.
Wow.
With Exorcism in Your Daily Life, the educational movie with Dad and Mr. Bob, Mr. Smith down at the bank and Doc. We used them all the way to the end of our career. We just loved them. And that was an absolutely early creation. Well, running back to earlier in the show, the seance, this sketch piece, was Austin just came in as Doc Beeson. You remember him from the from Waiting for the Electrician. He's the kind of metaphysical old prospector, right? He just was and remains, because it's on tape, absolutely amazing. So funny, out of the material, out of this little sketch material, which had a little stupid, simple gag. It just turned out to be great. And Peter at that point, you know, was played LBJ, which he then played for a considerable length of time, as we did political comedy in that time. So that was our opening night. And we had a show to do the next week. So we wrote the next piece and the next one and the next one and the next one. So by the time we'd written 10, we were pretty good at it, at writing half hour comedy pieces, you know, playlets. And the last one was, we'd done everything. We'd done Alibaba and the 40 Thieves. We'd done, Sherlock Holmes. We'd done them all. All of that kind of goon showish ideas. And Phil said at the end, he said, let's do a day of television. And so the last of these pieces was called A Day in a Life in the Day. And it started as, good morning, this is KWKW-TV in Indian Grave, Montana, beginning another day of broadcasting. You know, just that. And all vocal sound effects, all that stuff, no drop-in records, no nothing. And then we went on the road very shortly after that, early in 68, like any other band, to promote the album. So we took this piece out with us, and it kept evolving and evolving and evolving until finally it became the background text behind George Tirebiter and his activity on Dwarf. All of those television pieces were evolved over this long time of writing and touring, which began actually with this last Magic Mushroom show.
Did you have the George Tirebiter character at that point?
No, I had the old man character, the which was really a steal from Peter Sellers. Oh, you know, Major Bloodknock, is it big, you know, like this? Oh, my goodness gracious me. I learned a number of voices from listening to Peter Sellers. So he straightened himself out. I think by the time that album was done, I had an idea of who that character was, but it wasn't as evolved as it became over time. It took 3 years, and then Tirebiter reappeared in a live show, which is in the George Tirebiter collection from on Bandcamp. There's another 6 hours of old radio shows, and I did that show with Phil Austin. And it was his Hollywood Madhouse, which was Tirebiter's radio show back in the 40s. And we recreated that show in a little theater in Santa Barbara. Austin came up, played one of the characters on it. And that was Tirebiter's jump into reality. So after that, we knew what his radio show was. And then beyond that, it was just a matter of filling in a career that I didn't have, that someone 15 to 20 years older, except for Harry Shearer, older than I am. Harry was Jack Benny. You know, Harry had a lucky radio streak. And many kids did in that time. And they are, you know, as old as I am now, those kids. But it's old radio. I did a radio announcer. Phil Austin is Phil Proctor and his wife are doing old radio show recreations on Zoom Theater right now.
They did a Burns and Allen, I think, yesterday.
Yeah, they recorded it yesterday. Yeah. It'll be on the 15th. And I'm the announcer on that show. And these are really fun to do now. Anyway, the Tire Biter character evolved out of that live broadcast. Only one time. And took years to really turn around and keep existing in another kind of time, which is the way it does now. It was an old radio show, in quotes, but now it really is an old radio show, almost as old as I imagined it to be then. So George has been very good to me. I mean, it was, as I say, in 76, when we didn't have an album, the choice was to run for vice president, a giant nationwide comic, living theater? I don't know, you know, with 100 people at least involved, radio stations all over the country. I did, a big natural surrealist party, a convention in Santa Barbara, and then another one in Kansas, in the middle of the country, got to do it.
And that was the Papoon for president?
That was Papoon for president, yes. Papoon wore a paper bag over his head so no one would actually know who was under the bag, the philosophy being that anyone could run for president.
I think it's been proven.
There you go. See, we're right again. And George at that time was kind of somewhere between, he was kind of a lighthearted version of Ronald Reagan. I mean, he's a Hollywood star, promised to stay on the West Coast to balance the ticket, you know, all this kind of stuff. He was having a terrific affair at the time that was being, you know, we were publishing every month in Crawdaddy magazine. So the Campoon got upgraded every month and you found out all of the stuff that was going on. So it was a lot of fun. It really was a lot of fun. And then when we came back to work again, and now Reagan is coming into office, right? The 80s then loomed very weirdly. And so we couldn't get a record contract, which was naturally, that's like saying you're a painter, but yeah, we won't give you any brushes or canvas.
Right.
So what are you going to do? Well, we got a wall over here, you know, and some finger paints. So, but we decided we would do a live show. And out of that live show, man, we were going to get movie work, television work. It's just going to come flowing in. So we did three big shows at the Roxy music venue on the Sunset Boulevard on the Strip. And they were really giant shows. At least two of them would have been albums. The texts of all of those plays are in Fighting Clowns of Hollywood, my book, and also downloadable on Bandcamp. No one has really collected or heard those particular pieces. Joey's House, which was a rough draft of an album, which we did on stage, was a family that existed entirely on television. The opening scene, love the opening scene. Each one of us came out one at a time and clicked, mimed clicking on a television set, and immediately either became the morning news or an afternoon, you know, a show with you, a woman show with her. Each one, sports show, whatever, commercial, each one. So that all four of those were running at the same time. And Bergman played a Joey, who was a kid in a Dodgers cap or a Yankee cap, can't remember which, whose entire life was lived on television. His mother was watching those horrible Mexican dramatic programs,
and the telenovelas,
and she was going crazy in the bedroom. It really would have been a fantastic album because we would have moved the 40, you know, we would have rewritten and gone to the studio and done all of that. But that was one of the big shows. And there was a new Nick Danger called Frame Me Pretty, which, and by that time, we're doing all this, no scripts. We're doing this, you know, costumed on stage on the Roxy with microphones.
This is all improv?
No, but it's written, but it's improv around the writing. I mean, you know, what you could never... You can't give Phil Proctor a script and he won't rewrite it. I mean, Phil is a rewriter. and Austin, and we all just improvised our way through the basic structure of the scripts. That's why I say you, when you read the script in the book, it's bare of all of the nuance that you hear when you hear it as recorded in the theater.
Yeah, I actually wanted to ask you about that, David, because you have two George LeRoy Tirebiter novels. I see here the Ronald Reagan murder case published in 2006 and the Flying Saucer murder case in 2018. So a number of questions come up for me. One, what attracted you so much to the character that you've created this entire life from him, from his early radio show to his Porgy and Mudhead days to his old man, you know, looking for groat cakes and they never come up into the hills days. And then as a detective in these novels.
Well, a couple of inspirations here. Steve Allen, who wrote a series of mysteries in which he is the detective, he and his wife. And I thought, wow, good idea, gee. Because you have a persona, as well as being who you are. You have Steve Allen, okay. Well, Ray Bradbury, in one of his last group of books, wrote a series of mystery books, really terrific stories, in which he is the, quote, detective. Wow, Ray, really good idea. Gee whiz. I'm not going to be it. Who could be? Ah, George Tirebiter. So, I mean, it was logical to pick a character that I could work through. As I say, those, the two names I mentioned, 15 to 20 years older. They're from the generation that I admire, that I learned from. And then that was really the idea behind telling a story through the narrative of Tirebiter. Also, I'd written half a dozen half-hour radio plays that I did for workshops, deliberately with, you know, a set number of characters. And in the case of the Ronald Reagan murder case, I had written the first episode of what was going to be a pilot for a series. And I was at the Midwest Radio Theater Workshop in Missouri. There was a play scheduled to be done that concerned Native Americans. It crashed and burned, I think, as I remember, for very good reasons. And so they were desperately looking for a script. And I said, why is this? I happen to have this. And our dear friend of 40, almost 50 years, Richard Fish, can do any voice. He does those impressions, you know. And so he could do Ronald Reagan. He could do all the Hollywood stars. So I thought, okay, great. And I'll do Tirebiter. So that half hour was, we did it live. Once again, these are one time only at radio. It's here, it's gone, you know. And, but that was the beginning scene and the impression of the next scene from the novel. So I thought, well, this is, and now here comes my third influence, Raymond Chandler.
Ah.
Raymond Chandler pirated his short stories. He pirated what he wrote and said, gee, I can make this into a book. Bradbury did the same thing under the influence of Norman Corwin, who said, yeah, you put all these stories about Mars together and you'll have a book. Just write some internal narrative that connects them. Good idea. And thus the Martian Chronicles. So so I started from that place of recreating the place I knew very well, the CBS studios in Hollywood, and the methodology of producing a program in 1945, which I understood very well. And also because I love that period of Hollywood is one of my favorite times. So starting with that beginning scene where Ronald Reagan's body is found washed up on Malibu Beach, I just started to write. And with Tirebiter's, knowing that I would have two radio shows, two of Tirebiter's Saturday night, Friday night shows, and that would be the time frame. He'd have to solve the crime on the second radio show, you know? So, I mean, the thing, I've read and watched thousands of mysteries. they are basically the same thing over and over, you know. And so you can get away with a lot of shortcuts because everybody will go with you, you know. And that's a clue. And the book really wrote itself from that way. Then when it was published, I thought, well, what I want to do is like one of those old books that have the first chapter of the next book published in the book, and also maybe some additional material. But I really want the next story. So thus the flying saucer murder case, which was a little piece, and I wrote that into a short story, and then looked at that and said, oh, well, I can use this to write the next novel. So I pulled that story out of the book, substituted another tire biter adventure, a radio script redone, and found myself with the wonderful world of L.A. in 1945, 53, a noir period. He has been blacklisted. He owns a bungalow court near USC. And this is all out of my own childhood, all of this stuff. Only, of course, George is, you know, writing movies, and he's that much older, that much more into the business, what I can imagine, you know? So I had great fun writing. They would love me to write another one, Bear Manor books.
And you started as a writer, actually as a poet, and got into radio. And I heard you on Jason Clamm's podcast, Comedy on Vinyl. You mentioned that you actually interviewed some of the great New York City poets at the time. So you have kind of your roots in literature. Are there kind of advantages and some drawbacks to writing George Tirebiter books versus writing George Tirebiter audio?
Well, it takes a lot longer. I mean, you know, a decent mystery book is 60,000 words or so. And that takes not only time to write, but boy, you got to figure out the plot and, you know, all of that. So it takes up a chunk of time. Would I rather be writing audio? You know, if you look at either one of those novels, they started as audio. The first version of them was audio. So I have the audio in my ears all the time. We were talking, Judith and I, my wife and I were talking just a couple of days ago about the idea of, because Ben from Bear Manor Books would like, he said, would you like to read one of your books? So, you know, and I had gone, there's no money in it. I mean, the amount of time it takes to do. And then if you go through, you know, one of these major publishers, you're getting a quarter of 1% of their 2% of somebody else's 3%. And so it's chaos. And so that didn't appeal to me. But then Judith and I were talking about it. She said, well, why don't we just get, we'll do it as a play. We'll do it with all our actors. And there'll be voices. And I thought, oh, my God, here we go again. You know, it would be great fun to do a big audio production again. We'd love to do it. And maybe once this the strange environment that we are living in at the moment comes to an end, why, maybe we'll get back together and do something about that, like that. But that's farther away. But, and yes, and to go back to the beginning of your question, I was always a writer. I started as a writer. If I had to look at a career like Proctor, was always an actor. You know, where you acquire the other skills as you go along. But my identity, my personal identification, really from junior high on, was that I was a writer. And I've always said, well, a writer has to figure out how to sell his writing. And so you get into radio, and you got to do a lot of writing in radio. Some of it's just out of your head. You know, some of it's just, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to a program of music by Beethoven and Haydn. Tonight, that you're just there reading the back of a record jacket, or, you know, that's how I started.
And then you could leave for 30 minutes and come back.
Yeah. Oh, I had the hour long, the 56 minute one. That was it. The Schubert Octet. That's the one. You put that on, you could take the bathroom away, you know. Yeah. It was great. It was great getting into radio. It was perfect for me because I'd always listened to radio, and I became a producer in New York of interviews with the then happening, basically Lower East Side poets.
Allen Ginsberg, people like that.
You could title this Waiting for Allen. Everyone I interviewed, I talked to about 50 people, 50 writers overall, writers and publishers. The first 20 or so was all waiting for Allen. You know, well, we don't know. It was 5 years since Howl was published. Okay. And the world was waiting for what Allen was going to say next. And finally, just before Christmas of 1960, finally arranged for someone to bring Allen to the studio. And he came in and he has all his materials and all this stuff. And wait a minute. Yeah,
let's see. It's kind of like waiting for Allen Ginsberg or someone like him.
Waiting for Allen Ginsberg, yeah. What I really like about this, here's the book. It's called The Sullen Art. I say here it is, even though we're on the radio. But Allen was, what everybody wanted to know is what was going to happen next. Where was it going to go next? And the secret seemed to be, only Allen seemed to know what the secret is. So... This is a bit from the interview. So civilization's got to alter, I suppose, and consciousness. All the realities have got to alter. And there are the dinosaurs who don't want to alter. Poor dinosaurs. Part of it is the acceleration of mass media, the acceleration that we're actually leaving the planet. Wow, that's happening physically. So what happens mentally at a time like that with such fantastic complexity? I put my money on something interesting happening. I put my poetry on it, so to speak. I put my life for it, I think. I guess it'll be the same old thing happening again. And what is the same old thing? We are all one, man is one, man is brothers, or amor vincit omnia was what I thought the other day. Love conquers all through all the universes.
Ah.
So Allen sat down and started.
What is that excerpt from? What's the book?
That's the interview, and it's in my book called The Sullen Art, Recording the Revolution in American Poetry. And believe it or not, it's from the University of Toledo Press. And it has a CD in the back, which has the original documentary from 1960. Whether this is still in print, I mean, it's not that old. But, you know, university books, I don't know how long they stay in print. But that interview, then when that happened, he came into the studio with all of his stuff, notebooks and all this stuff. And here's the magic man, you know, I mean, it's a man, Allen Ginsberg, geez. And I signaled to the board op to just put on the tape and keep it running. Just go. He's I said, just put on the tape and go. And so the tape ran, and Allen talked, and right from the red letters, it's just an amazing, amazing interview. And what he felt, as indicated by that quote, was that this was the interregnum. I thought, what do you think? Is something, you know, it was right on the edge of the 60s. Right there. You could mark it on your clock. 22nd of December, you know, Allen's back in town. What's going to happen? And then I went on in the next year and interviewed a lot of other writers, but that was the singular one around which poetry was circling. The kind of poetry I was interested in was circling at that time. Although I would have interviewed and did interview very straight poets as well. I mean, also very interesting people. It's like a basic, for people who are into beat literature, this is like a basic text in the university world. So I did that when I was 25.
Don't you have your own book of poems that came out just a few years ago too?
So several. The most recent one is called The Old Man's Poems. Mm-hmm. Beautifully done book by a small press up in Bellingham, Washington, by an artist, an artist press. Yes, that's out there. You'd have to, every few years, the poetry books have to come out, you know. I still have a book of poems from the 70s I'd be happy to publish. You know, and I've been doing it all my life, really. When I graduated from high school, I published a book of poetry. So that was that. I've always thought, Judith and I talk about this a lot. And I came to a realization reading a biography of, a huge biography of Thomas Edison. Edison, like big, big fat book. And I realized that I may have been inspired by Tom Edison as a 12-year-old riding back and forth in a train in which he'd put his printing press so he could publish a newspaper, which he could then distribute on the train. Tom Edison, every time he thought of something, and he thought of a thousand things, he thought about how to make money from it. From the time he was a little boy, how to make a profit from it. Really interesting life. But there you go. Tom Edison, we had the Young Tom Edison Club. Tire Biter starred in a radio show called, Railroad Newsboy, Young Tom Edison, Railroad Newsboy.
Is that on the collection?
Yeah. That's all out of my, out of this, I think, one picture of Tom Edison as a little boy turning out this newspaper. I thought, well, you got to publish. That's what you do. You publish. I thought the same thing in when I first met Ray Bradbury. So open to everybody. So welcoming. So real. Famous. He was the model of what to do if you become famous. Is you're generous, you're open, you give your time, you aren't an asshole. And because there were a lot of them around in the science fiction world in those days, you know, military guys, Dianetics, Scientology guys, crazy.
Yes.
Yeah, but Ray, pure soul. And that was a lesson as well in how to conduct yourself, how to act. It's complicated to have a very long career in the public eye. You have to maintain it. I mean, unless you just give up. And who wants to give up? Because, the creation keeps flowing. The creative juices, sure, they diminish down as you get older, but it's still there. You know, I can't imagine not having that.
You could see that very few artists give up. Musicians, I've read about somebody like B.B. King would go up on stage. He could barely walk, but put him on stage and all of a sudden he's 20 years old.
Yeah, that's the way it was with these old guys that we worked with. Same thing. Put him in a chair, give him a guitar and right back to it, you know, all right. Amazing. And up to the last time that Phil and I were performing together, same thing. People see the camaraderie. They see that we genuinely love one another, that it's all this time has passed, whatever it is, but there we are together on stage. Gee, you know, when we had about five shows going, Judith and I, when this whole COVID started, we were in Kansas City at the Kansas City Art Institute. We left just as the first COVID death happened in Washington State and didn't know what to do. In our hotel, the Holiday Inn, which was the destination of choice for all the girls' basketball teams on Thursday, dead empty on Friday, not serving food on Saturday, closed on Sunday. And we were out of Kansas City, but Judith and I did a wonderful show together about our life. I have this piece that I was doing all around that was based on a script by a guy named Brian Price.
Oh, the old cart wrangler.
The old cart wrangler.
You were going to bring that to Portland too before the pandemic.
Yeah, yeah. But there were all kinds of activity in flux, and Phil and I have the History of Radio show. So it's all now Zoom, But I'm looking forward to coming back to stage, and it's everything you massage it all. It just gets better and better as time goes on. It really does.
Well, one last question, David. I think it's clear to any Firesign fan or anybody just listen to this conversation. There's so much you've done, and in so many different mediums: film, records, of course, radio, books, stage performance. Is there anything that you're currently working on or future plans? Something where you want to take things in a different direction? Something you haven't done yet. I don't know if there is.
It's terrible. I never learned to tap dance. one of my great regrets. No, I think, I'm sort of the promotion department at the moment, working with Taylor on getting these pieces out and getting them out in good shape and in better than ever. There's so much stuff, random stuff. On the e-waves, that to put out a really quality, thoughtful, what's it, curated product is what I'm concerned with. Am I going to write another novel? Don't think so. Do I write poetry? Yes, still happening. Yeah.
Any ideas about a podcast, maybe? Like Phil, you were on Phil Proctor's podcast with Sexy Boomer.
That was fun to do. We did a number of podcasts around the time that Dope Humor was released, like 10 different interviews, and a completely different feel out there in the world. I mean, I know if I'm talking to Kabu, I'm talking to people I know very well. I can say anything I want to here pretty much because you're on somebody's, comedy records of the, okay, what's the approach on this? It was amazing. Really amazing. You think, okay, we're over something. We're over having to prove it, And for a long time there in the 90s, when we get 25th anniversary, it was like, oh God, we got to prove it. Prove it. Bigger and better than ever. And I don't think we have to do that anymore. I hear the laughter, and that's really what it's all about. And also through Facebook, I get to talk to people. That has really been a good thing for the last year, as far as I'm concerned, the Facebook connection. It's wonderfully random. And so I can, put out ideas that way as well.
Well, David, I think we could probably go on for hours and hours, but it's a beautiful day outside. I know you want to get out on Whidbey Island today and enjoy it. And I just had a delightful time. Many thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, as and my salute to all of your listeners. A tip of the tire biter topper.
Well, that's all for this episode of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood here on KABU Community Radio, or KABU Neighborhood Radio, as I like to call it. If you missed any part of the show, would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.org/program/Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big neighborhood thank you to our guest today, David Osman, of the legendary comedy group, the Firesign Theater. We're also wrapping up our special programming Just For You fundraising drive for those of you contributing $120 or more, either as a one-time donation or sustaining membership. You'll not only get the satisfaction of supporting community radio, you'll also get, as our thanks to you, digital downloads of the Firesign Theater's latest projects, Dope Humor of the 70s, and George Leroy Tirebiter, the complete collection, plus a set of bonus Firesign material from the KABU vaults. It's as simple as going to the KABU website, kboo.org, and clicking on the big donate button on the top right of the screen. And you can always find out more about David and all the Firesign Theater news and projects online at firesigntheater.com. Just a note that Mr. Jones's Neighborhood comes to you monthly on every fourth Friday from 11 a.m. to noon. Tune in for our next show on Friday, April 23rd at 11 a.m. Hope to see you all again then. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying may it always be a beautiful day in your neighborhood.
ice cream cone. Hold on, I'll be right back.
Hey, wait for me! Wait for me!